Hey, this is Jeff Johnston, host of the new rebranded Living Undeterred podcast powered by Brighton. I am excited about this three-part series that I'm going to be rolling out, and I want to talk a little bit about this and let you know what to expect. So this is a three-part series, and the first topic I'm going to talk about is called The Road to Resilience, and it's going to be about the story, about the why behind the initiative that we do today, and to get you to dig deeper during times of difficulty in your life and understand that living undeterred really is a powerful resource for all of us. And so this series will be three segments. The first one is The Road to Resilience. The second one will be The Intersection of Health, Wealth, and Purpose. And this is an idea that I came up with when I was doing my research into mental wellness and what was lacking and the problem with the treatment industry in Western medicine today and looking at mental wellness and not looking at it as mental health, which is too clinical. So that is segment number two, the intersection of health, wealth, and purpose. And the last segment, which I'm actually quite honestly most excited about, and that is my faith. I'm going to talk a lot about faith. And so if you can bear with me, and I'm going to roll these out over time, and the last segment will tie it all together. And you'll understand what faith means to me, where my faith comes from, and why I think it's really important to have faith today during these difficult times. So again, thank you very much for coming back to the new Living Undeterred podcast powered by Brighton. And I'm excited to have this three-part solo series roll out. For those of you that have followed me, I did the Living Undeterred podcast for about 3 years. And then we decided to launch our startup company, Brighton, which is a empowered mental wellness planning app. And in doing so, I realized that I was cutting myself too thin and I wasn't putting enough into the podcast to make it worth. So I took about a year and a half off, and now we're back rebranding it, reinvigorating it with a clear intention of talking about mental wellness. And so today I want to kind of peel back the curtain, go behind the scenes. Let's go back to the beginning and let's talk about the road to resilience and who I am, where I'm from, and why this is important to me. So I started off in the wealth management industry. That's really where I got my post-college experience. My life experiences were in the investment world. And as many of you know, the investment world has a lot of challenges. And I was lured into it for the wrong reasons. For me, a lot of it was about making money for myself. Obviously, I wanted to help clients and do all that and build a good book of business. But from the early stages, my 20s and 30s, it was really a selfish endeavor, not a selfless endeavor. It was more about what I could do for myself. And as I got married and started having children and kind of got planted in my residence in between Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, I realized that something was missing, especially when our oldest son, Seth, started struggling. And it started very innocently, as most of these issues are born from small issues. And Seth struggled with school. Initially, it was just academically. Like me, he had an active mind. And I don't think the parameters that the traditional school system set, you know, square peg, round hole, here's our system, you have to fit in it. My son didn't really fit very well in that system. And then just like a lot of kids, like myself, he explored with things like alcohol and drugs. And it had, like most things in life aren't a problem until they become a problem. Seth was diagnosed, and I say that very loosely because I'm not a fan of this term, but was diagnosed with something called attention deficit disorder. And it came from requests by his teachers. In this case, our son went to Cedar Rapids Prairie High School, and this isn't any disparaging term, but people are going to find out I'm authentic and I'm vulnerable and I'm genuine, so I'm not going to hold back anymore. And you bury half your family, why the hell would I want to hold back? But our school system let him down by telling me that I needed to take him to go see somebody. And, you know, Seth wasn't getting expelled. He wasn't bringing weapons to school. He wasn't selling drugs at school. He was just struggling. You know, he was just like a lot of American youth today, or for that matter, probably kids all over the globe. And so I took him to see a doctor. And after a few meetings, I call it the hamster wheel. We walked out with this label on his forehead, attention deficit disorder. Oh, no, by the way, we have this antidote to kill this werewolf that you'll become. And it's called Adderall. That was it. That was the beginning. And like a lot of kids, Adderall wasn't the right tool for him. It just wasn't. Seth started taking too much of it and started abusing it. And then that opened up or allowed him to explore. It became a gateway to, you know, alcohol, marijuana, which are, you know, pretty standard today in society. I know I was an alcoholic for 30 something years and it started in high school. And we had a drunk driving. We had a breaking and entering. We had, you know, just a lot of childhood angst. And eventually Seth went to prison. And for a very unfortunate circumstance, which I won't share, but I talk about it in my book, which, by the way, the book's over here, if anyone's interested. I wrote it really to honor him and share his plight so no family would ever have to go through what we went through. And so anyway, so Seth went to prison, and my wife and I, Prudence at the time, really thought that prison was rock bottom, right? That's what everyone tells you in the addiction and substance misuse space is, they just got to hit rock bottom, you know? And so he went to prison. And I remember in Florida on vacation with my wife and my other two boys, Roman and Ian, getting a call from our lawyer who did exactly what I paid him to do. He said, "Hey, Jeff, I got great news. Seth's going to be released early from prison." And I turned to my wife and I said, I think that's the worst news we could have got today. I think that's the worst news because prison was a great structure for our son. He wasn't in for a long time. He was going to be getting out in you know, I know for Seth, probably every minute was terrible, but the reality was it was a safe place for him. And he was getting better. He wasn't abusing or using drugs, and his mental health was better when I visited him. And he was released, and it didn't take very long, but he got kind of sucked back into that lifestyle that he was in prior. And was introduced to heroin. In a batch, unfortunately, he picked on October 4th, 2016, was laced with fentanyl, which I had never heard of at the time. And Seth lost his life in a seedy hotel room in Waterloo, Iowa, on October 4th, 2016, at the age of 23. And that was the first time in my life where I realized what I thought was important really wasn't. And that I was chasing an illusion of what I thought was success. I was stunned. I remember the moment explicitly telling my wife that our son was dead, that Seth was dead. And you can imagine the horrific, earth-shaking grief and suffering and trauma that hits your soul. I can't even put it into words. That's the best I can articulate it. But telling Prudence that Seth was dead was the hardest thing I'd ever done in my entire lifetime. And we picked ourselves up and we rebounded. And I remember telling the boys, and I share this when I speak and I share this in the book, but it was important for me as dad to show strength. And this is, again, why I called this the road to resilience, because this is where really the idea of living undeterred was born, was in my living room. When the boys came home, Ian came home from golf and Roman was in seventh grade. Ian was in a sophomore. I'm sorry, Roman was in eighth and Ian was a sophomore. And they came home and I sat him down and I knew I had to say something impactful and that the next words out of my mouth were to frame and dictate the quality of the rest of the life of our family and still does to this day. And so what I said, and I had this feeling inside of me that it's like go time, man. This is what, you know, when you asked your beautiful wife to marry you, you knew you were going to have moments like this. You're going to get tested. I call these life moments. And this was one. And I knew I had to say something impactful. So I sat the boys down. Prudence is over to my right. She's obviously very distraught. The boys are 15 and 13. They can certainly sense the angst in the air. And I said, "Boys," and this became a chapter in my book called The Two Roads. And this really became the name of the podcast that I do now. And the choices that we make. And I said, boys, we have one of two roads to go down. We have one road of anger, despair, and hatred, and we'll become alcoholics and addicts ourselves. Or we have a road of motivation, love, hope, and inspiration, and we can use this moment to change the lives of others. I'm on the second road, and I ask you to join me. So I presented this as an option for them. And the fact that I said, I'm going to be on the second road, I ask you to join me, was important because I didn't want to tell them how to grieve. I don't think that was my job. My obligation as a dad wasn't to tell them. They have to feel this. They just lost their brother. How was I going to tell them how to deal with this? And so for me, it was important to present this as an option, as a choice. And they did. Both of them did amazing things. Ian went on to do some things that I still shake my head. And Roman became a certified scuba diver and is tremendous with working with the earth and plants and animals. And I'm so proud of both my boys, the way that they bounced back from this amazing, unbelievably painful day. And you would think that my big speech would have made a big difference for me, but unfortunately it didn't. And I stayed home for a year and a half with my wife, and I just got drunker for 14 months. I was already an alcoholic, and Seth's death set me over. And so I stayed home every day for 14 months and drank with my wife and just called every negative person I had in my head over to have the biggest pity party you could imagine. Why me? Woe is me. I'm a victim. And finally, after about a year and a half, I said, enough's enough. And on December 24th of 2017, I looked in the mirror and I realized my wife was really struggling. Prudence was 9 years younger than me, you know, and she looked 9 years older than me just in that year and a half that Seth died. So I said, well, I couldn't save Seth, but I certainly can save my wife. So I'm going to stop drinking alcohol. And that's what I did. I stopped drinking alcohol that day. And it's been the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. I've never been tempted once. I don't call myself sober. That implies I'm in some fight with some mythical creature. I just don't drink. It's not that hard for me. And somebody could say, well, then you weren't an alcoholic. Well, then so what? That's what you think. I drank for 32 straight years, 5 to 6 days a week. So whatever. I don't conform to the narratives out there that people tell me that I have to conform to, and I just don't drink. I did it initially to help her. If she wasn't struggling, I'd probably still be drinking. And unfortunately, it did not. And on June 29th, 2021, my lovely wife, Prudence, of 21 years, age 46, died of, on her death certificate says alcoholism, but we all know what it was from. It was from grief, trauma, suffering, pain, losing a child. Again, for those of you that follow me, which a lot do that have lost children, you know what I'm talking about, but you can't explain what it's like. And so in defense of her, she did what she thought was best for her. And that was to numb her pain with alcohol. But the other issue that I had with this was we found about 12 prescription bottles that she was taking after her death. So it got me really thinking about this reoccurring theme that Seth, you know, as an alcoholic and a person struggling with drugs, also was taking prescriptions. Well, then when my wife dies from grief, you know, and drinking, she was. And so the way the system's set up in our Western culture is to numb your pain, to try to make you happy, not to actually deal with the underlying problems. And so this set me off on this odyssey that where I'm at today, and why I host the Living Under podcast, and why I wrote the book, and why I bought an RV and went around the United States, part delusional, part in shock. But I had to do something. You know, I can't accept on my watch the number of people that are dying from the deaths of despair. And if you think of it this way, there's 909 good people that die every single day in the United States from the deaths of despair. And you may say 909, Jeff, why don't you just round it down to 900? Well, I'd be shorting 9 people. And every single one of those 909 deaths is important to me. And that's why I say 909. And the deaths of despair are alcohol, overdose, and suicide. So in my family, Seth, overdose, Prudence, alcohol. And when my wife died 4 months later. My mom died. And so in December of 2021, which is not too far ago, I sat in my closet. I used to be ashamed to admit this as a man. But I sat in my closet with a gun to my head, and death could not have been more painful than living. That was what I told myself. And that weekend, and I was a weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you can ask all my friends that tried to contact me, but I broke my phone. I broke my computer. I didn't want to talk to anybody. But I sat in my closet, and that spot to me in my closet, sacred ground today, because I respect that spot, because that's where I sat all weekend with a gun to my head. And I wanted to die, but not because of I thought death was going to be some blissful, fun time, but the pain of living was worse than death could possibly be. And I talked myself out of it. And all weekend, I counted down from 10, and I got the 3, I don't know, 1,000 times. And I didn't do it, unless in some odd twist, this is the afterlife, and this is what happens. I still sometimes am shocked that I didn't, because I didn't want to live so bad that I'm proud of myself I didn't. And for anybody out there that's been that close to dying, I love you. I respect you. I completely understand what it's like to want to quit. But the road to resilience is just that. That's the story. That's the framework. That's the foundation that we have built at Brighton right now. That's what I do. I want to increase human flourishing. I want to use my story to show people that in the worst moments of your life, which we all have those worst moments, that you've survived 100% of them. Think about those batting percentages. You've survived 100% of the worst moments of your life. What makes you think you can't survive the next? And you can, and so can I. So I'll wrap up the first segment today by just saying that I am grateful to be in this position. I have learned to reframe my life as why not me instead of why me, going from a victim mindset to what I like to say a victor mindset, and that if I can do it, anyone can do it. I really don't believe I'm that special. I know we all like to think we are, but I think of me being here in the middle of the heartland of America, just an average dude, been presented this amazing opportunity through death to become a better human being, not a bitter one. And so that's the road to resilience. And I hope this encourages all of you to dig deeper and just remember that brighter days are ahead.